This is Pop Fiction Women. I'm Corinne.
I'm Kate, and we're complicated.
Blunt.
Total boss.
But sometimes a mess.
Opinionated.
But never boring.
And in this podcast, we're discussing the complicated women of the best books, TV, and movies.
Along with the complicated women behind the scenes. Warning, lots of spoilers ahead.
So come back when you're done.
Hurry up, it's starting. We have bent the rules before on Pop Fiction Women. The rules, to refresh anyone who doesn't know, we only cover books, TV shows, and movies featuring women as lead characters and are created by women. And as I've said, we've bent those rules before. We've done some episodes that fall under what we are calling the female gaze. We've had Boomerang and Hamilton and soon-to-be-published Cocktail. Mm-hmm. These episodes take a traditionally male favorite and highlight the really strong, complicated, interesting women that are generally ignored or eclipsed by the male lead of this movie. But today, we are not just bending the rules, we're breaking them. We are doing Matthew McConaughey, Green Lights. It's a memoir, so it's not even fiction, about a man, written by a man, truly, really not even a woman in sight. I mean, he does talk about marriage, but doesn't talk a ton about his wife, Camilla.
No, correct.
But we still wanted to not only read this book for our own purposes, but we wanted to cover it on the podcast. I guess the question is why?
Correct.
Well, the first flash came to me when I saw the cover of People magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's Matthew in his two-day-old stubble and his huge blue eyes, smiling, mugging for the camera. And the words written across the whole cover are, "Being a dad was always my dream." Mm-hmm. And I was like, excuse me? This is a man who, okay, he was Sexiest Man Alive for People magazine before. We've seen that. But this, we're so far beyond those days. And I thought, this is a man who has managed to have a remarkable 27-year career in Hollywood, is considered a complete heartthrob, married a model, and just as his time might have been expiring, he reinvented himself playing serious and challenging roles, for which he went on to win a Golden Globe and a freaking Oscar, the highest honor there is for an actor.
That was his reconnaissance.
Yes.
As he coined.
Coined, yes.
Himself.
And yet here he is on the cover of this magazine saying, being a dad was always my dream. So we are covering Matthew McConaughey because he is flipping the script in Green Lights. And it goes way beyond even when the idea first came to us. There's so much more. This is this macho man's man who's also a ladies' man, good looking, charismatic, beer drinking, story slinging Texan.
Yes.
Who has played roles in his real life that are typically reserved for women in the movies. So by that I mean he has been objectified as eye candy. No one wants to hear what you have to say. We just want to look at you.
Mm-hmm. Pigeonhole him. Yep.
He has held his tongue for so long to be nice until he exploded into a violent rage. Mm-hmm. He is a sexual assault survivor. He is someone who values marriage. And he is a man who has dreamed literally of being a father since he was 8 years old. So all the tropes and storylines that are typically assigned to women, he talks about in this memoir. And it's pretty amazing.
Amazing. We both listened to it on Audible. I could not recommend it more. Even if you're not an Audible person, which I know you're not, listening to Matthew McConaughey read it, it was like being in his mind or in a movie. Like he would act out the parts of other people, different voices. Oh, God. It was so
like
good.
What I imagine being at a party with him would be like, right? You're listening to him in his own voice tell all of these wild stories that only Matthew McConaughey would have.
Right. Yeah, exactly. God, I want to go to a party with him. Jeez.
Oh,
I want him to make me a margarita Let's do this.
I'm in. There are a couple of things that he doesn't go into, but he does right out of the gate. I mean, I had texted you a picture. I had started reading the book as opposed to listening to it. And I texted you a picture of like page 5. And he has this list of things that he said he just wanted to kind of throw you off your idea of who Matthew McConaughey is. Mm-hmm. And in one of them, he talks about losing his virginity. And it does not involve either a frat house or roses, because I could see him going either way.
Right.
And it instead involved blackmail and was an experience that he held a lot of guilt about. Mm-hmm. That kind of
threw me off. Right? Yeah.
And then the next line is, I was molested by a man when I was 18 while knocked unconscious in the back of a van. What?
Yeah. No, what? I did not know any of this.
He doesn't go into it, but he puts it out there. And that, again, is a story that I've never really heard a man. I mean, a woman could do that. A woman could be like, yeah, I was sexually assaulted when I was 18 in the back of a van. And you wouldn't be surprised in any way. And this was like, what?
Well, it's we had this exact opposite when we did Jessica Simpson open book. I had not known that before about her until I read the book. And while I was surprised, you're right, it wasn't, you know, you're sort of unfortunately like, oh, yeah, you know, that happens, you know, which, again, is really unfortunate that we sort of assume or take that for granted when we're reading a memoir by a woman, but a memoir by a man. I was shocked. It does have a different effect. And
he could have left it out easily.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And I don't know, that was powerful for me.
It was. Did you want more? To hear more about it? Because then you really don't get anything else.
I can't say I did. Yeah. I didn't. I didn't. I didn't want more. But I did read, someone asked him. Interestingly enough, it was not a woman. It was a man. It was an interview in Men's Health magazine. And he said, point blank, what's that all about? And Matthew said, that's not a story that I can share right now. And when the reporter asked him why he chose not to revisit the second sentence later in the work, he says, it's not a scar I've carried through my life that is psychologically holding me back. At the time, he talked to some close friends, never mentioned it to his parents. He said, it wasn't permanent in my brain. I was able to go, nope, that's done. That's not going to be something that defines me. It was a fucked up moment. It was a really fucked up time. And I'm glad I got out of it without being really, really harmed. I moved on. I turned the page on that. I didn't really look back.
Wow. It's not a person who hasn't done a lot of soul searching and done the work in his life that I would think. He's a person, I believe that a little bit more than the average person.
You are right. He is introspective. He is 51 years old now. Okay. Australia. So after he graduated high school, he took a gap year. He got a year in Australia sponsored by the local Rotary Club, which I just love.
I know.
But that year went downhill quickly. The family that he stayed with was odd at best, and he was deeply unhappy. So he did what so many women do. He turned to controlling his body as a way to get a handle on his out of control circumstances. Again, this theme. He decides he's going to run 6 miles every day. He decides to be a vegetarian, but he doesn't know how. So he's essentially eating, actually eating
iceberg lettuce.
A head of iceberg lettuce with ketchup on it.
Oh, my God.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
And he reads Lord Byron in the bath and masturbates every single day.
Yes.
And I heard him talking about this, and he said, you just need something, some sort of reachable discipline to accomplish a day, to keep your fucking sanity. And that's what he was doing. This interview is actually with Dax Shepard, and he was saying how he did the same thing. He went to his body and was like, okay, I can do this. I can run and change my diet and all this stuff. And that's how I will control the situation that's out of control outside of me.
I don't know what you're talking about, Corinne. I have never heard of anyone doing that. Oh, wait. Oh, hi. Did anyone listen to our episode on Untamed? Because I pretty much confessed to that. I mean, not as extreme, but I completely and utterly relate to trying to control exercise and diet as a way to get a rein on the what feels out of control.
I do think it's a more typical narrative for a woman.
Yes.
And I don't know that I've ever heard, I mean, I've heard plenty of men talk about changing their bodies for a role or... Right.
Not because I believe men don't do it. I just think, to your point, they don't talk about it.
It certainly isn't
part
of a conversation, right? I wouldn't be surprised at all if a woman said that. If a man says it, it's like, whoa. Huh,
and if the man is Matthew McConaughey, I mean, like, really? Wow.
Right. You think he has everything going for him.
And he really did then at that time when he went there, right? It was in high school and he'd talked about right after high school, right? And he was most handsome and the most popular and straight A's. I mean, when he left for Australia, he was on top of the world at that age and time in his life. But he was miserable there, so.
The story gets even more wild. The host family has unreasonable expectations of him. They're odd, like I said, at best. But I'm thinking to myself, he, as a man, the men, as the story goes, would say no to all these unreasonable impositions. They would know how to handle the situation. They would say no. They wouldn't worry about being nice or keeping the peace. They would just stand up for themselves because that's what men do, but women don't always do that. And here he is doing the same thing. He just, no matter how crazy it gets in this house, he is always trying to, he says, take the high road. Women call it being nice or keeping the peace. It's the same thing, though. He is essentially denying himself entirely to make space for them. And he's shrinking as a human being.
And convincing himself that it's just cultural differences, right? Is that what he always says? You're right. Doesn't want to complain. Right. Doesn't want to make any waves.
Well, then the family asks him to kiss a girl on the lippies in front of them.
This is so weird.
And they insist on it to the point that you're even listening, you're uncomfortable. I wasn't even in the room. Everyone in the room is uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable listening to it. And he knows he's not going to do this, but he's also trying to get out of it with finesse. And every single woman I know has a story like this. At some work holiday party or even Thanksgiving with someone's drunk uncle, and here he is forced into this physically, almost sexually uncomfortable position, and he doesn't know what to do.
He doesn't want to insult the girl. He also doesn't want to sell. She's got a boyfriend. He wants to be respectful for him. Yeah. I mean, it was, as you say, one of those awful, awkward encounters that they're forced into. And how do I get out of it?
Right. And again, you've heard all of your friends tell that story, but zero men have I ever heard that story from. Although there is normal people, Connell with that teacher, it's probably similar to that, right?
Oh, that's right.
At some point, Matthew realizes he's got to get the hell out of this house. So he arranges to stay with a new family in Australia. And at the last minute, this host family, the father, tries to stop him from leaving. And now, again, as a woman, you know what's coming because you've been there. You've held your tongue and been like, this is fine, you know, it's fine. And then you lose your shit in a violent rage. Yes. And he describes rearing back, sends a vicious left hook through the bedroom door, which is made out of plywood. So his fist goes clear through it like it's air. He pulls his arm out, bloodied and full of shards and splinter of plywood. And he tells this man, quote, "You get your fat fucking ass out of my way or I'm going to beat you to the ground and drag you across your gravel driveway for so long you're going to be pulling rocks out of your back until the day you fucking die."
That's where it wasn't all that female-like.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know about the punching someone in the... Yes. The threats of physical violence. I can give a tongue lashing like nobody's business. Yeah.
Yeah.
That could leave someone stunned. I've never knocked anybody out or punched anybody.
Well, he didn't either. He just said
he punched the door, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. He put to the right. But he just loses his shit. And I'm also thinking about movies and books where the woman just loses it and kills someone. It might not be good or healthy or whatever, but it's so goddamn relatable. And here we have Matthew McConaughey doing the same thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
It really is.
Yeah. I was listening to an interview again with him talking about that particular story. And he said that there's great value in denying a crisis. It forced him to go inward. I was thinking of wondered how he would work with Glennon's Four Keys, right?
Yes.
From Untamed.
He saw a lot of similarities here in some ways.
Yeah, but he did not feel, no, imagine, let it burn.
No.
He did not do those steps.
But yes. I think he felt like afterwards or towards the end, he could reflect.
Yes, after he was kind of, and this reminds me of Jessica Knoll, Luckiest Girl Alive, you only scream when you know you're safe. It's not
right.
The Glennon Doyle model. It's
right,
the
exactly.
Ani Finelli or Jessica Knoll model.
Right, once he got out of their house.
Again, constantly flipping the script, telling stories that are typical stories that women tell. This is the position I got into. And he could have written an entire memoir based on behind the scene antics.
Yes.
And
the women he dated or whatever,
yes,
you know,
his craft of acting, if you wanted to be serious about it. These were the stories he chose, and that blew my mind.
Also based on, what, 35 years worth of journals? That alone,
yeah,
to me flips the script. I'm not saying that there aren't men who journal every day, but
you're
I've
right.
never met any.
And not even just like, oh, I wrote about the most important moments, you know. Sometimes people only turn to their journals when something big happens. But
right,
this is like a consistent practice for,
yeah,
35 years. That is flipping the script there. Yeah.
Another one. Even before he meets Camilla then, I wanted to talk about this wet dream that he had before.
Oh, God.
Well, he has a lot of wet dreams, which, yes, first, that is a interesting way to come to,
yes,
very significant realizations in your life. But before he meets her, he had this wet dream about, you know, these roving cars coming through with a different wife and four kids in the back of each. And these were his kids, but
right,
he was old and unmarried. And he said the red light vision of being a lifelong bachelor came in a green light wet dream. It was a spiritual sign, a message to surrender, to quit trying so intentionally to try and find the perfect woman for me,
right,
rather concede to the natural selection process. And then he talks about how he realized he just needs to let it go and,
yeah,
surrender. And that, to me, this, like, in really is the whole concept even behind the book, which is,
mm-hmm,
and it all feels very feminine to me, and I don't mean that in the gender sense, but
yes, I am.
This idea of surrendering, we talk about all the time on this podcast and with so much of the content we do, of letting,
mm-hmm,
go, of following signs and like paying attention to your intuition. And he's really,
yes,
internalized that. That's his,
yes,
way of living and way of life. And that to me also seemed not like something you typically hear from a man.
That is so true. That is so true. Because I had that same part for myself, but I had been thinking about it from the simple fact that he had been trying so hard to,
right,
find someone to marry and the one, and this, he'd been trying to force this relationship. But you're right. The whole idea behind it, this, yes,
yeah,
green lights is really tuning into your intuition. And that is something that's typically reserved for women. It's frankly, usually women's intuition is,
yeah,
usually,
you're right,
the term.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's really what he's talking about throughout.
Yes.
I mean, that's what Green Lights is about. I really don't think you would expect out of the, you know, celebrity male heartthrob.
And what he got out of that dream was that the most important thing for him was to be a father.
Yes.
And maybe he would never find a life partner, but it was more important for him to be a father.
And then, of course, the minute he lets go,
mm-hmm,
you know, it's like the very next scene is, you know, he does finally meet Camilla.
The target drew the arrow.
Yes, I love that. I love
so
that.
So should we just back up and talk about this book? Like, there are so many amazing things that you're listening to it and you're like, was that the most profound thing I've ever heard, or was that not even English?
Yeah. He does these things where he's like, bumper sticker. But whatever follows the bumper sticker is exactly what you just said. Either super profound or head scratcher. Like, I have no idea what the fuck you just said, but it sounded good.
And when you say either, I think it's both. It's both. I'm yeah, like, ooh, right. That's really profound. But then I'm like, did he just put a bunch of double negatives and then add, what did he say? Did he actually say something or not? I'm not sure, but my life has changed.
Yes. And you have to think about it. And you're like, wait, well, no, I mean, I guess that makes sense. So wait, he's got bumper stickers, prescriptions, poetry, which is his own poetry. I mean, shit, even that. How about flipping the script? I mean, just sharing this.
Which he had been doing since he was very young, writing his own poetry. So he meets Camilla in a club, a nightclub.
The description, I think, of him meeting her and when he first saw her, I mean, besides just being so fucking romantic, I was listening to him describe when he first saw her, and the first thing I thought of was, he loves a complicated woman to go with this podcast. Like, the description of her, the very thing he's attracted to is her contradictions and her complexity. I mean, I wish someone would say this about me.
She made an impression and a definition. Naughty and fundamental. Young with a past. Homegrown and worldly. Innocent and cunning. Springtime and salty. A squaw and a queen. She was no virgin, but she was not for rent. A mother to be. She wasn't selling nothing. Didn't need to. She knew what she was, who she was, and she owned it.
Look at what he, no, you're like, so he loved right in her immediately. Yes. What he connected with. I don't know how the fuck he knew this all off the bat, but good for him. You know what I mean? But I'm sure there's some liberties there in writing it. But that's what he saw. Just all these, that she was all these things.
And, right. And that was what made her intriguing. I loved that he talked about both fatherhood and marriage in such an active way. Again, I said before, it's not like your father or your grandfather's family values, which is just like it. That's such a traditional idea. He does not falsely praise Camilla for their kids. Like, it's her job to take care of the family while he takes care of work. He does not talk about a traditional division of labor. It doesn't even sound like they have any division of labor. It's more a tag team.
Yeah.
He would never be accused of babysitting when he's got the kids, right? He is a get down on your knees, play with them in the dirt, set boundaries, teach them lessons, talk and wax poetic. He digs deep for answers. And he uses an example which combines both things, is when his three-year-old son essentially asks him why his parents aren't married. And a three-year-old, I don't even care if he's almost four, you could blow off that question easily. But Matthew McConaughey does not. He says, if you are a parent, you know there are questions our children ask us that as soon as the words come out of their mouths, we know we better have a good answer, because that answer is going to be burned in their mind. That's very intentional. That takes a lot of work and care. You don't hear that coming out of a lot of parents' mouths, and that includes mothers and fathers.
And I think his answer
takes
it one step further. I mean, his son says, are you afraid? And he said, I guess I am. I'm afraid of losing myself.
Which is another typical female line of thinking, that you're going to become someone's wife and mother and lose your identity. I've never heard a man be like, oh, I might lose myself if I get married.
Particularly when the man is Matthew McConaughey. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
It's like, what? Like, how are you going to lose yourself?
You're an icon.
But that's what he was worried about.
And so he investigates what he calls the mystery of marriage. He goes to his pastor for counsel. He talks to friends. And he has some great quotes here, I think. He says, "The adventure of living side by side does not steal the individual sense of self. Rather, it enlightens and informs it. How when two people come together to marry, they each arrive as one whole being. And in marriage, we don't lose half of ourselves. We become more of ourselves." Mm-hmm. It takes courage and sacrifice. But after he does this searching, he says, "Marrying Camilla was something I needed to do." Because he had told Levi, he doesn't want to get married they're supposed to do it. He wanted to need it.
Yeah. He didn't want it to be out of obligation or a sense of, well, that's just what people do.
And then he did.
He did. Yeah.
I love what she says to him on their wedding day at the altar. She says, "I don't want nothing, just all you have to give." And I was like, yes!
I know. Yes! Do you think that was, I guess that was her vows.
"I don't want anything from you. I just want all you have to give." And I'm like, yes, that is marriage. That is, don't ask for anything and expect everything.
Now, what do you think about when he asked her when he was falling in love with her? And so this is obviously before they got married and had kids even. Mm-hmm. When he said, "What would I have to do to lose you?"
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember this part?
Yes.
And she goes, "Oh, that's easy." And I was like waiting. I'm like, oh my God, what is it? And she said, "Change."
Yes.
And he went, "Woo." Yeah, like, but I was thinking, but people, so I wanted to get your thoughts on it because I'm
yes.
I mean, people change and grow and evolve, but she means change who you are, like fundamentally on the inside.
Yes, okay. I think so. I do think it was more of something that change that's inorganic. That's
right.
I thought it's the best answer you could give because I was so afraid she was going to say something like, "Lie to me, cheat on me."
Oh, yes.
You know, like something.
I knew it wasn't going to be. It's so funny. I was thinking, this can't have anything to do with honesty or lying, or Corinne will throw this book out the window. And I really did think that. I was like, I hope that's not the answer. Because he pauses for a second.
Right.
I actually did have a time to think. I'm like, ooh, what's she going to say?
Oh, absolutely. He knows how to work this story that you are hanging on his words. And sometimes he speaks so quickly. But
so
it's like,
fast.
Ooh. And then other times he just knows exactly where the pauses should be, where the story slows down, where he waits a beat. Oh, obviously he's a great actor.
But then he says, "Since that evening, I have not wanted to spend time with any other woman. Definitely have not wanted to sleep with anyone else. I've not wanted to have children with anyone else other than her." And then I love this. He's like, "We have a love that we never question."
Hmm.
So even that line, I was thinking, what does Corinne think about that? Because I would think that I do think, knowing them, that they do question, not their love, I guess, but I assume they're both pretty self-reflective and do like diagnostic on their marriage, maybe. But maybe that's different than what he's saying, which is they never questioned the love.
I think so. Yeah, I think it is. And most of the problem is when you feel disconnected.
Right.
But that's still like that love is always there and not at all at question.
They're so cute, those two. They're just beautiful people.
There's a lot of romantic stuff. And I didn't write them down because I didn't know you were going to go in this direction. But there's a lot of kind of romantic stuff that he says about her. You know, he's an actor. He's a flair for the dramatic.
Yeah.
But he's also incredibly down to earth. Right? About what kind of work marriage is. And he says, "I believe trying to maintain a honeymoon glow in a relationship is a fool's errand fantasy. It's a 120-watt bulb that burns too hot to last, but the 20-watt bulb isn't enough to see the way. The honeymoon bulb is not attainable nor sustainable. But where our humanity lives, where our secrets, scars, fears, hopes, and failures reside, that is what comes after the credits roll on that Hollywood fantasy. Where it's not easy, but we get to honestly try."
I love that part.
He has so many of those. He combined both so beautifully, the romance plus this is not just a honeymoon phase. You don't even want that honeymoon bulb. It's too
exactly.
Bright.
Yes, that's not where the magic is.
There was one, the poem he wrote, how he didn't feel like making love to his wife, but he did because he knew that even though he didn't feel like it, the making love would be nice. And not only would the making love be nice, but then the breakfast that he ate afterwards and his conversation with someone after that and his
tequila
day.
At night would taste better. Everything would be better after that. Yeah. I love that, because even the line about he didn't feel like it seemed like something, you know, that maybe a woman would say, like,
right.
You know, I mean, men are, well, they're always ready for it. I mean,
whatever. Yes, that's the normal dialogue that we have. And no, here he is dispelling even that. This virile man.
Yes, right? Yes.
Who plays bongos naked. He sometimes doesn't feel like having sex. And he fakes it until he makes it.
You know, by the way, that's like advice therapists and others give, usually to women. I mean, I have female friends all the time who tell me, well, like the therapist says, I should just try because after I'll feel better. Or I have friends on their own who just say, I don't know, I hardly ever feel like it. But, you know, afterwards, I'm glad I did. You know,
yes.
Not very romantic, but him saying that.
Right. Him saying this not romantic thing, he made it completely romantic to say that his tequila that night would taste better. The sunset would be brighter, I think he said. I mean, it was just like, okay.
Yes, sir, it will.
Yes. So fatherhood also was obviously he's already talked about how it was his dream to become a father. And From the age of 8, that was his goal. There was nothing really more important than that.
I feel like you guys have similarities there.
Yeah.
He said that the only thing I've ever known I wanted to be was a father. He said that came to me at 8 years old. I remember my dad was a big sirs man. Please and thank you and shake someone's hand. You look them in the eye. I remember being an 8-year-old kid and meeting these men, and I would look up and shake their hands. Yes, sir. Nice to meet you, sir. So in my 8-year-old mind, he says, the common denominator, besides respect for elders, of why I was saying sir to them was that they were all fathers. I remember going through my 8-year-old mind. Oh, that's when you've made it. Oh, that's the pinnacle of life. That's success. I knew from that day on I wanted to be a father. And then later when he gets the ultrasound, he says, again, all I ever wanted to be was a father, because he said that meant a man had made it in his life. And my question for you is, but that description still sounds very male to me, or masculine in the gender sense, like his choice of words and like his reasons. Because do you think women like view it the same way? Like when a woman says all I've ever wanted to be in life was a mother, which lots of women do, why do you think they say that? Meaning, I feel like for women, it comes more from like nature, like from the inside, like it's innate, biological instinct. You know, to me, I've never heard a woman express the desire to have children because it would be something that would make her feel successful and revered the way he talks about. So I was interested, because I know you're a person who said from a young age that she wanted to be a mom.
Yes. And listening to him opened up an entirely new vocabulary for me, because all of that rang very true for me. I cannot say at 8 years old. I mean, I don't think anyone can say at 8 years old, you don't have the hormones that will help you procreate. So it wasn't biological for me at 8 years old, or mine was even younger than 8. So it was not biological in that sense. And I've written an essay, and now that I think about the essay that I wrote and how the two things I wanted to be pretty much from kindergarten were a mother and a lawyer. And I don't think they were separate in my ideas of being the most successful human being I could be.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the converse is true for women, in the sense that maybe when a woman can't conceive or has trouble conceiving, they may feel like a failure. So that it's their fault,
that they didn't succeed.
So I can almost see the inverse, but maybe that's the same thing then, that it is, what he's saying is it was tied to his self-worth in a way. that if he could be a father, that meant he was successful, that he had made it. And maybe that is similar for women. I don't know that I would hear women express it this way.
You are absolutely right. And now I understand what you said, that it is a masculine view of looking at things.
Right.
It takes the caretaking, nurturing aspect out of it. It's almost like my greatest ambition is to be a father. And that is not something, right? I've never heard a woman say my greatest ambition in life is to be a mother.
Right. Or now I'm a mother. I've made it.
Right.
I've made it. Right. But I do think, like I said, the opposite would be true. Like that a woman who can't feels as if they maybe haven't made it. I'm not saying all of them, but it is very common.
Well, I certainly felt that way. Yeah. When we couldn't get pregnant, every single month was like utter failure.
Failure. So I guess it is similar.
I was going to say this later, but first of all, let me just say that he is very clearly, I mean, procreating itself is not an important thing. He was talking about being a father. He talks about his parents having a lot of troubles, and always his mother left and he was left with his father. The father was the one who stayed. It was always a very active and involved thing for him. It was not simply producing children. It was
right.
Being a father.
Yes.
And
exactly.
Yes, as you said, I do feel like him. I feel like we run a lot of the same feelings and themes in my life as what he's talking about. And all the while I was thinking it's less important, maybe entirely unimportant, really, for me to say any of this. But him saying it, I think, has two benefits. First, it opens the door for other men who feel this way to be open about it, because these are very domestic things and they're not commonly even discussed or mentioned or talked about or having your all over People magazine, right?
Yeah.
But the second is something I think I'm a little more excited about. I think it gives the women, I hope it would give the women the freedom to say, this is not how I feel. I flipped the script. I didn't want to be a mom since I was 8 years old. And even though I love my kids and my family, they are not the core of my life, the way he talks about so much in this.
Oh, God.
What?
No, because that's how I feel. I was like, I have a lot of trouble with this because I don't actually, I never had these notions of I want to be a mother.
Right. But I think when all of these conversations are out there, then I think that it's, you understand there's at minimum four boxes, right? You're the kind of man who felt this way. You're the kind of woman who feels this way. You're the kind of man who doesn't feel this way. You're the kind of woman who doesn't feel this way. So
yes, and there are lots more boxes now since we aren't just defining people by he and she. So you're right. There's probably more than four.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There are
absolutely
so many permutations now.
Beyond. But for the core conversation to include all of this, I think is, again, it's why I don't talk very much about my kids. I love them. This is an important part of my life. It's an active part of my everyday life. And it is very unimportant for anyone to hear about because I am a woman and this is not a new story. For him to say all of the things that I feel is not so much like validation. It's so wonderful to hear a man say those things because you can have a completely healthy family life and not have it be the core of who you are the way it is for him and the way it isn't for so many people. And
yes.
I do want to come to this. So he does talk a lot about his parenting, and I think he does what many modern parenting experts poo-poo these days, which is I think he makes parenting a verb. Right. It is such an active, he probably puts more into it than is necessary. But the fact of the matter is that he takes life as a verb. He literally says that many times in this.
Yes,
life is a verb. And so being a father, being a parent would be that for him anyway, just as every other aspect of life is. And I think the problem is when typically women take parenting as a verb and they make that their entire life.
Yes.
But the whole time he's got these three kids, And this is when he reinvented his entire career. His career is incredibly important to him. Again, not that I'm Matthew McConaughey, but just like me, I wanted to be a mother. And when the lawyer thing wasn't working out in the same way, I never lost any of my ambition. Never. It just shifted focus. And I still, to this day, I maintain that. So it's not that
because you know your priorities.
Yeah, I
think because your family is your number one priority. I mean, that's where I think then he's able to look at things. As long as you know what's important to you, then you can see all the other things fall away. It's like when he saw that ultrasound and the first thing he did was shut down his production company, his record label. He said, if you believe him, I mean, it was instantaneous because he's like, I'm doing too many things, not all getting a B in all of them. And he immediately saw what was important and reprioritized. And I think that's a great skill, first of all, and to be that self-aware.
I don't love the idea of priority. I wouldn't say my family is not my first priority, but I also wouldn't say they are. I like the idea of what he says, that the family will always be at the core of him. That's how I feel. It is almost fundamental. It's almost beyond words, beyond discussion. It's just the core of everything I do. But it is not everything I do, not by a long shot. I don't know. I also loved that he thinks actively about how to give his kids yellow and red lights. Yes. He said, they're not going to struggle the way I did. How do I give them the right amount of resistance? We can't just give them all yeses, all green lights. That's doing them a disservice. This is clearly a man who has thought deeply about how to build his family, how to raise his children. And he's actively, as much as he talks with so much love about his own childhood, his own parents, he is very, very different. And he is a different father. He parents differently. So,
his father, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, he's also, spent a lot of time alone. I mean, which is how you get this reflective and introspective. A lot of people don't do that. They don't want to do that. Maybe they don't have the luxury of doing that, of course, but the guy goes deep.
He does. And did you hear, and he talked about how he wrote this book. He spent a lot of time alone with his journals, although he wouldn't say he was alone. He was in his own company as he read his journals for the past 35 years. And he laughed, he cried, it got bloody, he said.
But that's how you shut off the noise and hear what's happening inside. And I do think he does that a lot in his life.
Yeah, and having journals from that far back, he could reconnect with, oh, this is what I believed when I was this age, and this is, how that changed, and that's pretty amazing.
Thing at the end that he read, that he found from, 1991, on the back of a piece of paper, the eight ten goals, and he had literally fucking hit every one of them, including winning Best Actor, an Oscar for Best Actor, and he wrote that list after he just did his very first acting role in Dazed and Confused. So, I mean, it was as far away from being a Oscar winner as you yet that was on his list. Do you know his astrological sign?
I do, of course.
Oh, okay.
What did you think?
I would not have picked a Scorpio. He seems, I would have thought maybe a Leo. I would have thought maybe a fire sign.
He's way too introspective.
Yeah, I guess so.
Especially as a man, a water sign made much more sense to me. What else? There was a lot of God, a lot of faith, a lot of higher being talk of it. And he talked to his pastor a lot.
Yeah, his faith is very important to him. Yeah.
Yes.
He's from Texas, man. I mean.
Yeah, but Texas is a funny state. It is not one thing, and especially not Austin.
Right. And Austin is definitely different.
Right. Both. And it's so much of both. He talked about that in another interview, how the university being right across from the Capitol is this bridge of old and new and blue and red. And structure and progression. And it was
What he loves most about Austin is that you can just be who you are, he said, whoever you want to be.
Yeah. And he talked about a lot of progressive ideas and liberal thinking, but with this backbone of traditional conservative thinking. So it seems like the perfect place for him. He is
surprising.
He is complicated. He holds both things to be true. And then at the end, he talked about COVID. He said COVID forced us in all inward, literally quarantined us to search our souls for a better way forward. In doing so, we took inventory of our lives and who we are in them. What we care about, what our priorities are, what matters. We got to know our children, families, and ourselves better. We read, we wrote, we prayed, we cried, we listened, we screamed, we spoke out, we marched, we helped others in need. But how much do we change for good, its sake, and forever? For those of us who survived, when and how we see the benefits of those turbulent times is relative. But he believes that the red light year that 2020 was, will one day in the rear view mirror of life inevitably turn green and perhaps be seen as one of our finest hours.
Green light. Yeah. I love right? that. That he, yeah. In the rear view mirror. I hope so, Matthew. Right. I really do.
Yeah. And that's what he's saying. It's on us. And this period of time will force us inward. And the longer it lasts, I think the less in danger we are of undoing all of it. But it is, the test will be of whether it was a red light, a yellow light, or a green light is green how light. We carry it forward.
Afterwards. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever that means. But
yeah,
this was just an absolute delight.
So good. I'm glad we bent the rules. We just broke them. You're right.
Broke them.
Bend,
here.
Break, whatever.
We've been bending all along, but this was snap in half.
We want to let you know we've launched a Patreon page where supporters can receive perks like bonus episodes and exclusive content.
Because Pop Fiction Women is our passion project, a place where we give women space to show up and offer in-depth analysis in the ways we're used to hearing about male creators and their characters.
We delve into creativity and psychology with a dash of astrology, and we have so much fun doing it. Just two friends breaking down books, movies, and shows like Normal People, Fleabag, and I May Destroy You.
Every single aspect of this podcast we do ourselves, from the preparation to the recording, from the editing to the social media promotion. So we're adding a Patreon platform because we want to keep making the show you love and hopefully expand it even further.
So please consider becoming one of our most complicated fans and contributing on Patreon.
To learn more, go to patreon.com/popfictionwomen.
This has been Pop Fiction Women with Corinne and Kate.
If you enjoyed this show, please tell the complicated women in your life.
And the men who love them.
Yes, tell them to listen. And then to follow on Spotify or review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And of course, share on social media.
Tag us with your favorite books, TV shows, and movies starring complicated women on Facebook and Instagram at Pop Fiction Women. Or on Twitter at pop_women.
For more coverage of the women you love, or to find out if you qualify as a complicated woman, go to popfictionwomen.com.
And keep it complicated.